Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. In this week's podcast, we talk all things wet and watery with the winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize. We take a spin through the literature of cycling, but first, the Romantics. You might think they're just a lineup of dead white males, but all the way through next week, we on The Guardian will be breathing new life into them with a series of booklets which will bring to your breakfast table some of the most famous poetry of all time. To remind you just how sublime poetry can be, here's a young Michael Sheen reading Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn.
Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme. What leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape of deities or mortals or of both in Tempe or the dales of Arcady? What men or gods are these? What maidens loathe? What mad pursuit, what struggle to escape? What pipes and timbrels, what wild ecstasy? Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on. Not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth, beneath the trees, thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever can those trees be bare. Bold lover, never, never canst thou kiss, though winning near the goal, yet do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not thy bliss, forever wilt thou love, and she be fair.
That was Michael Sheen reading Ode on a Grecian Urn, as part of a Great Poets of the Romantic Age audiobook, which is published by Naxos. With me in the studio are Nicholas Rowe, editor of the booklet series, and Andrew Motion, biographer of Keats, and one of a distinguished lineup of writers who have contributed introductions. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, Claire.
Hi.
Nick, first of all, I wonder if you could just fill us in on what these booklets are, why we're doing them, and who's written the introductions.
It's sort of a follow-on to a series we did a couple of years back of great 20th century poets, and we had some pamphlets of Eliot and Auden and Ted Hughes and Plath, and Andrew here did a terrific intro to the Philip Larkin one that we had at the time. That went extremely well, and we've been sort of thinking about doing another one, and the Romantics seemed right. We kick off on Saturday with Andrew introducing a pamphlet of Keats's poems. Then we've got Germaine Greer on Byron, we've got Don Patterson on Burns Night, although Don is fairly acerbic about haggises and associated Burnsiana. Margaret Drabble writes on Wordsworth, we've got Richard Holmes on Coleridge, one great atheist, Christopher Hitchens on another, on Shelley, and then Philip Pullman rounds up talking about the very strange and the very wonderful William Blake.
How did you go about picking the poems? I mean, Wordsworth, certainly, you could fill a year's worth of Guardians with Wordsworth, couldn't you?
Not only did these people write stacks of poetry, a lot of them also wrote very long poems. So went back to that list of experts that I've just listed, who came out with some terrific ideas, both for a sort of combination of shorter, complete poems and then extracts. I mean, Andrew cut out some tremendous stuff from Keats. Germaine Greer, in particular, got some tremendous stuff out of Byron. She was very concerned that we shouldn't have too many short Byron poems. She'd rather have extracts. I think he's much better at full bore, she said. One of the biggest problems was formatting some of this stuff. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner comes with some very strange commentary in prose at the side. Now, our elegant little pamphlets are very narrow pages. We couldn't really make it work, so we went back to Richard Holmes, who gave permission for us to actually drop these things, and the line he uses, "I'll square it with Coleridge."
Andrew, did you have to do a lot of squaring with Keats when you were dealing with
nothing so pragmatic as that? Though if anybody can square it with Coleridge, Richard would certainly be able to do that. But I think the point about so much of what's most important to us and has been most important to people in the past about the romantic achievement being there in long poems is an absolutely right one to make. I mean, Keats didn't either have long enough or the sort of stamina to write poems of the kind of length that Byron did and Wordsworth did. And the one long poem that he completed was one of his least successful ones, Endymion. But the two big unfinished fragments, Hyperion and The Fall of Hyperion, have wonderful golden moments in them. And I simply tried to choose some of that in order to represent what he was interested in those longer things.
Mm. One of the things that we discovered, or Nick was telling me about, was you find how unstandardised the texts are.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Keats ones are slightly less chaotic than others because they've been gone over so many times by so many different people through so many generations. But it is very striking how unstable quite a lot of the texts are. Mind you, it's surprising how many great poets of all periods have rather unstable texts. Eliot, presently, for instance.
Mm. Now, how useful, going back to the beginning, is the term romantics?
I think it's most useful if it allows us to feel that when we're talking about the first and second generation romantics, which is an important point to make as we go along, I think, that it's not just one sort of wave of writers, it's at least two, and arguably more than two. But as we talk about those waves of writers breaking into the minds of their audiences, we realise there's something very fundamental to their interest, which we recognise, and that is that they speak about the self in terms that we recognise as being basically akin to those terms that we use now. I don't mean that Donne and Pope and anybody writing before the Romantic movement is writing poems in a way that are completely alien to us in that respect, but I do mean that the centering of the self and the idea that the self, as it perceives what's happening to it, is delivering, as it were, merely but wonderfully a set of subjective responses, that's an enormous change in the global psyche, if you like. And it introduces a world that we can categorically consider to be modern, and that's the world that we live in.
Mm. Now, we used to talk about the Big Six, didn't we?
Yes.
But then I have seen Thomas Chatterton included and John Clare.
Well, Clare, certainly. I mean, Chatterton, it's very difficult to talk about the Romantic movement and all its aspects without mentioning Chatterton, because the brevity, the fierce burning, the tragic early demise, and the interest in alternate to voices that Chatterton manifests, those are absolutely core to the Romantic idea, if you like. The achievement is more elusive, perhaps, than those points make it sound. In the case of Clare, over the last couple of generations, it's very difficult to think of a poet whose reputation has risen further and faster than his, because we have learnt, and high time too, interestingly, this takes us back to thinking about structure, I think, and form. We've learned to respect the more broken, more fleeting, less marvellously completed structures of his poems for the things that they are. And that means that we've simply been able to give him more points than we used to do in the old days.
Mm. There aren't any women in this grouping, are there? Are there any women romantics?
Well, there are in the background women romantics, and there are very vitally women, and this is rather a sort of two-sided thing to say. Of course, there are very important women around the men doing the writing, too. You might say that Fanny Brawne is one of those, and that's something I think that Jane Campion brings out very interestingly in her film. More clearly, the role that Dorothy Wordsworth plays in Wordsworth's life is absolutely indispensable, and she's a wonderful writer herself, not of poems, but of diaries and letters and so on and so forth. So there are women there, but you're right. I mean, it does look, as you said in your introduction, a pretty white male panorama.
We made a discovery, or one of my reviewers discovered Letitia Barbel just before Christmas.
That's right.
Rather fortuitously for us, since we desperately needed a book of the week that week.
Good. Well, I'm very glad. I mean, she is interesting, and there are other people of that sort of scale and size, and there might be academics whose special interest those people are, who want to make a higher claim for them than people generally do make, but they're there.
Mm. Now, in my introduction, I used the S word, sublime, and yes. I probably used it incorrectly. I used it in its modern sense. Can you just explain to us this quite difficult concept? What is the sublime? What was the sublime to the Romantics?
Well, to put it at its simplest, this is an idea which derives originally from Edmund Burke, in which the contemplation of some terrifying thing, object, landscape, concept, particularly mountainous scenery and steam-filled gorges and this kind of thing, in other words, crossing the Alps and all that jazz, inspires in the person looking at it a sense of awe and wonder. So it's a strange and rather interesting mixture of fear and dread, is how I would characterise it if I had to write my definition on the back of a matchbox.
Mm, so it's not the best, which is often how it's used.
It does now. I mean, the sublime goal, as it were.
Yeah. That sublime football
kick. Yes, exactly. I mean, that clearly does not quite mean what the Romantics used it to mean, though maybe it's in there somewhere.
Yeah, yes. And how important do you think they are today? I mean, have we not moved past them with modernism and postmodernism Are we all romantics at heart?
We're all romantics at heart. I mean, Yeats very famously says the last romantic's dead and gone, doesn't he? But actually, the last romantic is still walking among us. The last romantics are... We are the last romantics. Every generation is the last romantics. Because what every generation has to do is make a negotiation with this idea of the self that they embody. So they will never be gone. I mean, of course, we don't think in quite those terms anymore. And of course, our sensibility, our sense of what a self might be, is more nuanced and in some respects significantly different now. But fundamentally, it's the same, I think. So to consider the modernists as and the postmodernists as the only modern people seems to me a very serious mistake. The romantics are the first moderns. Mm-hmm. And their modernism, as I say, lingers in the air we breathe.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nick, we were playing with the idea of possibly having a romantic legacy for the seventh issue. Who were the names that were tossed around?
We half got down the path of having a line of taking this to the present day, and we sort of took it through the Victorian age, and they could pick up someone like Ted Hughes, and we seemed to come to an end at something like Morrissey. This never happened, but yeah, Andrew's quite right. The romantic thing goes on. Their same preoccupations are the same preoccupations of artists and people today.
Mm. And of course, we did. There's a small issue of copyright when you come into the 21st century, isn't there?
Well, yes, there's that as well, yeah.
The first booklet on Keats with an introduction by Andrew Motion goes out with The Guardian on Saturday. Byron will be in The Observer on Sunday, and on Monday, Burns Night, we will of course be honouring the Bard of Ayrshire. Now, the winner of this week's T.S. Eliot Prize lives in a different part of the country, Wales. Philip Gross is also deeply affected by nature, though not strictly a nature poet, and he came into the studio earlier this week to talk about it. He began with a reading from his winning collection, The Water Table.
Poor. Call it connecting one moment with another. Water in the glass with water in the jug. Two bodies of water. And between, this slick and fluted glitter, slightly arcing, rebraiding itself as it falls. As for tangible seconds, it's a thin, taut string of surface tension that my hand feels on the handle as a pulse, a pull, a thing in space that lives in this world like us, with purpose. Though not one least particle is constant, knows its place, could account or be held to account for what it is or does.
Welcome, Philip.
Thank you. Now,
were you surprised to win this prize?
If I say that I had made plans for the day after, which included being external examiner for somebody's PhD viva, it tells me that I wasn't really expecting that I would have anything else to be doing on the day after the award.
Ouch. You're a poor student. That's a proper sense of priorities, however.
But it did get examined and it went just fine and she passed.
Yeah. Now tell me, how does the T.S. Eliot rate? We've got three big poetry prizes in the year, haven't we? We've got the Forwards, T.S. Eliot, and then I suppose you'd count the Costas, although that's more of it's slightly different in that it's a part of a general roster of prizes. Which one is the jewel in the crown?
It is widely thought the Eliot is the big one.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, it's partly because of its illustrious history and its name.
Of course. And part of me actually would rather not talk about bigness in the world of poetry. It's not a claim that matters. It's good reading. What I know I will get after this is that book will get read better and more deeply.
Now, this is about water, and interestingly, there have been lots of very successful collections about water recently. We've had Sean O'Brien's The Drowned Book. We've had Don Patterson, who won the Forward with Rain this year. We've had, of course, Alice Oswald. What is it with all this water? Why do you think it is that poets are clustering around it?
Maybe an awareness that life is flux, an awareness that even ourselves and anything that we think of as having boundaries, like nations, races, classes, even genders, that have more fluid and changing boundaries than people would once have thought.
This collection is characterised by a fascination, it seems to me, with the textures of water. There's a lot about sort of the braiding of water and the way that it falls and the way that it atomises.
What feels important about water is that in some ways it is the simplest thing on earth. Water only knows how to do one thing, and it does it supremely well. It knows how to go downhill.
And very powerful because of that.
And yes, ask a Taoist and they would say, what is stronger than stone? Water.
It's particularly located on the Severn, just right on the inlet of it, the lip of it.
Absolutely, yes.
Is there something particularly powerful about the idea of an inlet like that, the mouth sucking in water from the sea?
The phrase that keeps on coming back when I look out at it is a body of water. That view from the Welsh side, where you can't see out towards ocean around the corner, it looks like a wonderful inland sea.
Mm.
It so palpably flexes and stretches each day because it has these massive tides.
Mm. Now, you're also fascinated with the bits in between, and this is something that interests me because I've noticed this in-betweenness coming up in a lot of different work, novels as well as poetry, actually, recently. You write about gulls going home from the city from a day's work at the landfill. So the landfill is part of this continuum with the water as well.
In ways I've gradually realised in my adult life, I think I was born to that between state as possibly the only half Estonian, half Cornish person I've ever met. So living between cultures like that. Not that I was brought up with that Estonian history. That's my father, who arrived as a wartime refugee and never spoke about his history for years and years because it was a trauma. He nobly, but maybe wrongly, thought, why pass that on? I think the answer was, if you don't pass it on, what you pass on in its place is a silence.
Mm.
So being brought up in that between place, between those lands and between those languages and between words and silence, maybe it just fitted me out at an early age to be quite responsive to that state of neither one thing nor the other.
Mm. Now, interestingly, there's a 7-sonnet sequence at the centre of this, which is about IKEA, isn't it? Which, of course, is an in-between cultures sort of place, isn't it? And also in-between places sort of place.
Absolutely. You can be in one of those and you can be anywhere on earth, can't you? And yet mysteriously find yourself speaking Swedish.
Yes, you point out that the books on the shelves are Swedish, which, yes, seems a detail that actually I do remember noticing myself. The sonnet's a very disciplined form. You're using quite a lot of forms here and you're using them quite rigorously, which of course is a reminder that you are also a teacher.
I'm not sure that I would link those two facts, teaching and rigour. Given that what I teach is creative writing, if we teach anything, it's some careful balance between discipline and rules on one hand and responsiveness and openness on the other. So yes, don't
assume
rules with teaching.
And one of my favourites is Amphora. Which is, you could say, it's not a concrete poem, it's a clay poem. It is actually, it falls on the page in the shape of an amphora.
Absolutely, yes.
Is that something that you've played with a lot?
That was the first time I think I dared to do one of those in print. It's a game, and a serious one as well, but it is a book in which I think I'm being bolder with writing with space as well as the words themselves, and all of that says, let's engineer that bit more space or that bit more silence in here, because after all, in the end, you are building with words and silence. Mm.
The form of the amphora leads you to the base of the amphora, if you can picture this on the page, and the base of the amphora is Homer's Wine Dark Sea, so it's taking you back to the origins of poetry, which I thought was very neat.
It also takes us back to an author who might not have existed at all. That might be a name for many Homers.
Mm.
And I like that origin, that beyond this world in which we ask who won the prize and which one is the big one. Actually, we all own this, and it only works, it only grows, if it's a conversation ongoing with each other.
Philip Gross. The Water Table is published by Bloodaxe and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Andrew, one of the nice things about Philip winning is that he's not a fly-by-night. He's been going at it for a very long time, hasn't he?
He's very much not a fly-by-night. He's a stay-by-day, if you like. And I think that's a very good thing in a prize like this, which can... I think judges can be made to feel that they must reward youth and newness and so on. Louis MacNeice, in one of his long poems, says, "The middle stretch is hard for poets." And that has about it a kind of weary, middle-aged feel, which I think is, well, we know that MacNeice himself felt it very strongly, and I think it's a note to which every middle-aged bosom such as my own would return an echo, frankly. So for those reasons, it's very nice to feel that the judges in this year have rewarded somebody who has continued to work in an often overlooked, fundamentally modest, but still very compelling and authentic way that seems full of integrity. I think it's a good choice.
At least there is a middle stretch. I mean, a lot of forms of literature that you really have one, it's one hit and you're out.
Well, that's right. I mean, and of course, the history of, I mean, speaking about the Romantics as we just have been, one of the interesting things that they have in their legacy is the idea of the poet going off the boil or having to die young in order to be any good and so on and so forth. And I think that has, ever since the Romantic movement proper faded away, it has left in the popular mind an idea of that being, or those being, the archetypal shapes of a poet's career. It's very easy to look at examples through the 20th century of people who do either sag in the middle and never get it back, or, like MacNeice, sag in the middle and then finally, right at the end, do get it back. So to watch a writer like Philip Gross, who's gone ploughing on in a successful and sort of fruitful way through what's now quite a long career is exciting to see.
Just after we did the interview, actually a bit too late to put it in, unfortunately, he thrust into my hand a book of poems he's done with photographs about the footings of electricity pylons.
Oh,
so I thought, there is
good
a man who is not tired of life.
No,
what a great
certainly
thing.
Not. But no, very good idea, and actually typical of him.
And Nick, was it a surprise that he got it?
I don't know if it's a surprise that he got it. I mean, it's a terrific book, and it's much deserved and all the rest of it. I mean, I was on the forward panel that gave the prize to Don Patterson, so I was surprised that Patterson wasn't even on the shortlist. But there was a little bit of crossover. I mean, I think it's long enough after the event, so I can say that in the forward, if there was a runner-up prize, it would have been between Hugo Williams and Christopher Reed. Both of these were on the shortlist. Christopher Reed's got a chance to win the Costa next week, so he still might win something. And Philip Gross, I think because of the way the dates fall, can be entered for next year's forwards. So he may even pick up a double.
So Don Patterson, Philip Gross, all comes back to Wet and Waterly, which Andrew Motion assures me is not a tautology.
not.
Thank you very much to both Andrew and Nicholas Rowe for coming in. Now, what could be more poetic than riding a bicycle? The Irish poet Derek Mahon is just one who has saluted the bike in verse, referring to himself as half man, half bike, which of course is a reference to Flann O'Brien's wayward masterpiece, The Third Policeman. But I have to tell you, a lot of bicycle poetry is actually very bad. There is, however, a growing literature of cycling for those of us who prefer to take our exercise in the depths of an armchair. It's not a literature that often crosses the desk of your average literary editor, but it has everything from scandals to celebrity machismo to the loftiest philosophical musings. Earlier this week, I buttonholed Guardian sports writer Richard Williams for a special Bike Books podcast. I started by asking him about books on cycling personalities.
Cycling has more than its fair share of heroic figures, and some of them are tragic heroes. And Coppi and Tom Simpson, both of whom have been written about by William Fotheringham in very successful books, are two of those major figures. Tom Simpson died in 1967 on the Mont Ventoux during the Tour de France.
I've been to see the shrine there. It's absolutely extraordinary.
It is, and it's very touching. And when Bradley Wiggins rode up the Ventoux during the Tour this year, he'd pasted a little photograph of Tom Simpson to the top tube of his bike. And David Miller, I think, threw his cap onto the shrine as he went past as well.
So this is a story, a tragedy really, isn't it?
It's very much, well, yes, it's a story of glory as well, because Tom Simpson went to, you know, in those days, continental cycling was the thing. And, you know, to make it on the continent was the best thing you could do. And Tom Simpson, who was a man from North Nottinghamshire, from a mining village, went over and did that and was extremely successful, won the World Championship, did well in the Tour de France. But, you know, in those days, most of them took amphetamines and goodness knows what, as Simpson certainly did. And that contributed to his extremely premature death. But it's a very, very resonant story, and Fotheringham wrote a very fine book about it. And then he went on to write about Fausto Coppi, who was a cyclist of the generation immediately before Simpson. Coppi really came up during the years immediately after the Second World War, when Italy was undergoing a reconstruction. And William's book is almost as much of a portrait of post-war Italy, people, you know, racing through the rubble, as it were, as it is of Coppi himself. And again, it's a very, very evocative book. It's a wonderful period piece.
Now, what about fiction and the literature of cycling?
There is one great novel of bike racing, and that's The Rider by the Dutch novelist Tim Krabbe.
Who's best known for The Vanishing, isn't he?
Much better known for The Vanishing, except among cyclists who know him as the author of The Rider, which is a sensationally good book about the experience of being an amateur racer, what it's like being in the peloton, you know, all the experiences you have before, during and after the race. All the sort of anxieties and little triumphs and little jealousies, little worries, all sorts of things. It's a very, very fine book indeed. I'm surprised there aren't more. But then there are not a great number of really, really good sporting novels, perhaps because sport tends to contain its own narrative and any kind of fiction based on it tends to feel false.
Now, one of the loveliest books I've read recently was the Graham Robb Discovery of France, which we mentioned briefly at the beginning. That's a very serious historian who just, by going around on bikes, has made a new narrative, it seems to me, in the way we look at France. Do you know that?
Yes, I do. It's a marvellous book. And the Tour de France is responsible for engendering a deeper and greater interest, I think, in France. It takes you to bits of France. If you watch it on television or if you're following it in person, you know, you probably go to a lot of bits of France in any given year that you didn't even know existed. I know I did. This year I followed the whole thing from beginning to end. And I know France reasonably well, but I found some corners that I'd never discovered before. And it's a constant delight. And it does encourage you to look at France in a much broader lens, no doubt.
Richard Williams. Now, he said there wasn't a huge number of bicycle novels. If anyone can suggest others, please let us know. It's something we'd like to return to at some point. There'll be more of that bike books discussion on the Guardian Bikes podcast next week at guardian.co.uk/bike/blog. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you to Andrew Motion, Nicholas Rowe, Philip Gross and Richard Williams. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley. Goodbye.